Let's see here. So I think that's it about the fixed rate formula, because I feel like we've talked a lot about this in the past and that you guys have kind of a handle on it. But certainly if you have questions, let me know. But just in the interest of time and trying to get through all of it, we could probably go to the next slide if there's no questions. Okay, so this section of the code deals with the rental cost. And currently the formula is written into the resolution that we will do the calculation based on 23% of the rent amount for households, for a certain number of households within the HUD income guidelines. And so these, what you see on the screen, these are the current rental amounts in our program. For a 60% AMI, so that's what we call low income, or an 80% AMI, which is like a moderate income household. So what we are proposing is to change the essentially formula for calculating those rents to just reference the Oregon, the HUD home rents. So HUD publishes their own rents for a program called HOME, which is a lot like CDBG. But that those home rents are also used by Oregon Housing and Community Services for affordable housing providers. So affordable housing providers, if they're using any funding other than our funding, like tax credit money, Oregon Housing and Community Services money, and home money, because they do use home money, they are required to use these rents by those programs. Our rents are not consistent with these, and so it creates a little confusion and also a little difficulty for the affordable housing providers. And as you can see, the low home rents are a little bit higher than how ours come out at that 23% calculation, but the 80% are actually a little lower. So there is a little bit of difference there, but I think in the end, it is really about consistency for the affordable housing providers and how they are administering the units and the rents for their tenants. So this is another piece that's just part of that. You know, it's been 15 years since we've updated this resolution. You know, at that time we have household income asset limitations. We have those for households that are below retirement age, which I think we define as 65. And then above retirement age. So a household cannot have more than $20,000 in cash liquid assets or $130,000 in liquid assets. And that is, you know, just what we require at this time. So as we are just going through and doing some basic housekeeping even on the resolution and the land use code, what we had decided was we should probably look at CPI and adjust these forward to the current time frame. And so we went ahead and did that. And what that results in is that a household that is under 65, or a non-retired household, can have a maximum of $25,000 in assets, or a retired household can have a maximum of $175,000.
Hey, Linda, can we stop and just kind of take general questions here?
Sure.
Well, if no one else, I have one in relation to the previous slide that it goes in. When you read all the recommendations that we're doing, they seem to make it easier for either nonprofit or profit developers to develop housing somewhat. On the other hand, I like the cost to the people at 60% or AMI is going up under that. And does the convenience, it lowers it for the 80%, but it seems to me that the overall effect of all of these that we're proposing is going to make it just slightly bit harder and less availability for the very low income side of our community. Is that true or not true?
It is somewhat true. If you think about it like this, the Housing Authority of Jackson County is mandated to to provide affordable housing. And they're mandated by state and federal programs to use these home rents, which are higher than our rents, but that these are the low income currently throughout the, you know, our area, Medford and Ashland, Jackson County, that, you know, 608 and 730, those are the rents for people earning 60% of your median income. So we are the only ones in our area who have a rent that is lower than what essentially HUD is saying a 60% area median household can afford. So where I see what you're saying, that yes, we are, our lower price is going away for a sort of convenience piece, but that HUD believes that these rents are not exorbitant for a household of that income. Later, when Brandon, I don't know who will talk about it, Brandon or me, I can't remember, but we'll talk a little bit about that we are sort of removing some housing, ownership housing. I wouldn't call it a mandate, an option for ownership housing. And it isn't removing it because you can still do it. But we'll talk a little bit about that later. So I feel like maybe that's...
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But I think it is relevant to this particular question. Currently, developers that are required to do affordable housing often look at providing the units at 60% AMI because they only have to do 15% of the development at that lower income level. We've had comments from affordable housing providers for ownership, Habitat for Humanity specifically, that 60% AMI ownership is not tenable with their funding streams. And they're looking at providing options for people at 70% AMI. That's ownership, but the corollary to that is that's also a rental category, and we're looking at modifying the eligible rental categories to newly include people at 80% AMI and below. And so currently developers, unless they're voluntarily providing affordable housing, cannot qualify for units at 80% AMI. If some of the land use changes go through, we want to have a rent target for 80% AMI that is commensurate with the home program, because that is, again, reflective of what people can afford to pay, where ours are slightly higher. But you're totally correct, Rich, in terms of the home rents at 60% AMI are lower. The one part that Linda didn't indicate is that some of the low-income households that are in qualified low-income rental units are also receiving housing vouchers, and those vouchers pay the difference between what that household could afford and the rent that can be charged through this program. So in a sense, by increasing the low rent for people with vouchers, their costs don't go up, but it does provide more voucher reimbursement to the housing provider.
And I would also add, Rich, too, I mean, we have two different populations. We have renters, right, 60% of area median income renters, and then we have homeowners who are at that 60% area median income. And I think the latter piece that we'll get to in later in the presentation is really about, you know, low homeowners at that income level. It's very difficult to loan to them or for them to find loans at that income level. It isn't impossible, but it's a very narrow field. And so just sort of back to that feedback where we're, you know, always trying to balance the desirability and the ability of this program to be functional, is that those units have a really hard time transferring again. So when someone may have gotten into it, which actually we have those, 15 years ago, and they were able to get a loan, now when they go to sell that unit, because, you know, whatever, they have life circumstances, they have to change where they live, it's really difficult for them. It's a very small pool of people who can buy that unit. And so essentially they become stuck. And like I said, Habitat used to be one of the only lenders, and they are saying that they can't do loans that low. On the renter side, so our program, the 60% AMI that we would calculate applies, you know, to any unit that is a rental in our program that targets that income. So not all of ours do. Some target 80 for rental. And so, you know, not all of them are affordable housing developers, and not all of them can be rented. So the impact of us changing that 60% is probably fairly minimal, except to the affordable housing providers who have sort of a larger stock of rental housing.
Well, and the people that have to pay it. But anyway, that's all right.
Right. Sure.
So to me, there should be a distinction between rental and ownership. I understand the logic of raising it to the 80% AMI for ownership due to loans, but we're really sort of penalizing, not greatly, but a little bit, especially families. People with more children are going to pay higher rent under the new model than they would have before. And while $50 or $60 or whatever doesn't seem like a lot, it can be a make or break issue for families. So that's my only concern.
Sure.
And I don't know if there's a way to change the numbers slightly so that, you know, that rental is perceived differently to me. Because if they had the resources to purchase,
sure.
Yeah. But they don't. That's why they're renting.
I can ask a clarification question of Linda, if that's okay, Rich. Does the housing authority, is my understanding, did they get an exemption because of the funding stream being federal that they had to provide their units through the home program and charge those rents even within Ashland?
No, they don't charge the home rents in Ashland. They would charge the lower rent.
Okay.
Because they're required to by us. And they would only charge that on the number of units that we would have required. So like with the Snowberry, not all of those were required to be affordable.
Right. Only 17 of the 60 or of the total 120 were actually requisite to be affordable housing.
Right.
Through annexation.
Yeah. And you know what? Let me figure out how many units in our program this would affect. So, I mean, it may be that, you know, there are a number of units, but it may be that there are not that many. And so, honestly, I'm not sure off the top of my head. So
that would be nice. Yeah.
So I was going to go through the requirements for affordable housing that would be subject to change through an ordinance amendment. And as a preface to that, affordable housing is only required as part of proposals that are requesting to annex into the city, requesting a zone change, doing a conversion of existing apartments into condominiums, or voluntarily requesting to get density bonuses for affordable housing. And each of those would be implicated by the changes that we would be proposing. The first in this list is probably the most complex for people that don't do land use every day, but essentially base density is a calculation that of how many units per acre is allowed. So I'm going to use some round numbers to describe it, that for instance, if we required 12 units per acre and there was a property that was 2 acres in size, the base density of that property would be 24 units. If that was an annexation, and they were doing 25% of the units as affordable, they would be required to do 6 affordable units. A concern has come up in the past in terms of properties that have large undevelopable portions of property, either steep slopes, floodplains, wetlands. In those cases, a property developer may only be developing half of the property and proposing to do 12 units, even though the base density for the 22-acre property is 24 units. But the way the code reads, it does allow a reduction in density to exclude undeveloped portions of property for the total number of units provided, but it's not explicit when it comes to the affordable units. And so questions have been raised as to whether that developer doing 12 affordable or 12 units would have to still meet the requirement to make 6 of those affordable, in which case the project performer and the financing for a development such as that just would not work without deep subsidy. So the change that we would be looking at is to clarify that for the same as properties within the city limits, that base density is calculated exclusive of areas that are not otherwise developable, even for affordable housing calculations. The next one gets to what Linda and I were speaking on previously, that we currently have a matrix set up in our code that delineates how many affordable housing units you have to do for an annexation or a zone change. And the lower the income target for those units, the more those units count toward meeting that goal. And so if you wanted to provide all the units at 120% area median income, effectively you'd have to do 33% of your development as affordable housing. If you wanted to do all of the development at 60% AMI under our current code, you'd only have to do 15% of the development as affordable housing. And what we were seeing is that developers gravitated toward that lower limit without having a full understanding of whether they could find development partners that could actually achieve that. And so they were selecting that 1.5% equivalency value so they could provide fewer affordable housing units, although they would be essentially targeted to lower income. But without affordable housing providers as partners, they've not been able to achieve that. So one thing we were looking at considering is whether to newly add rentals under the 80% area median income so that we could have some rental stock that comes in under that limit. So again, that's a change from what's currently in place, and it does relate to the newly allowing rentals at 80% AMI to qualify as affordable housing. I should state that this doesn't preclude somebody from doing 60% AMI for rentals or ownership. A nonprofit that still had that as a goal and had those subsidies, such as the Housing Authority, it would still qualify, but it would only qualify at that equivalency value of 1.25. So they'd end up doing 20% of the units as affordable instead of 15% of the units as affordable under this change. So questions on that one? So this is a three-part slide. I'm going to start with the household sizes used for calculating initial purchase price. And Linda spoke on it initially in terms of all the various factors that go into establishing the initial purchase price for a home that's covered under our unit for purchase. The first and the most primary of those is the household income. And this is the HUD table currently for 1 through 8 person households of what qualifies as 80% area median income. The reason this is relevant is when the house first comes into the housing program, we don't know the household size of the person that is the house that's going to be occupying it. So the purchase price is defined using an average of household size in our ordinance, where if it's a studio, we assume a one-person household, which means that that household couldn't make more than $36,500 a year to qualify, and then the purchase price of that studio would be reflective of that wage. A two-bedroom previously was identified for a four-person household, a three-bedroom for a six-person, and we had a category for four-bedroom units for a seven-person household. Since the program's inception, we've never had a four-bedroom unit. But further, what that meant is that if somebody did do a four-bedroom unit, they would be determining, establishing the initial purchase price based off of an income of $64,650. And a three-bedroom unit would be based off of an income of $60,450. Through changing this, what it effectively does is it lowers the assumed household size and therefore lowers the presumed income of those households so that the cumulative formula change for the initial purchase price will reduce the formula-based price of those housing units. So that's convoluted. I hope I was able to explain it, but I know that this one is very confusing in some sense. But essentially, under the current formula, a three-bedroom household at 80% AMI could sell for $231,300 because it's based on an assumed six-person household income. Under the revised proposal, that three-bedroom unit would sell for $214,800 because it's based on an assumed five-person household. This is not to say that somebody with a six-person or a seven-person household or even a two-person household couldn't purchase a three-bedroom unit. if they were income qualified and were able to get lending. It just says for that very first purchase, when it newly enters the program, that would establish its initial price. And then going back to slide number one, if we switch to a fixed-based formula, these prices would go up by 1.5% each year thereafter.
Brandon?
Yes.
Are you assuming a 5 or 6 person household would all be working adults?
No, this is based off of the HUD standards. So I think a 4-person household is really the baseline, and Linda might be able to speak to me this better, but its assumption is 2 working people and 2 children mm-hmm. is a 4-person household. And I would assume a 5-person is really 2 working people and 3 children is probably the more target.
But you said that correlates with a higher income.
You can see here in this table that the incomes do go up slightly according to HUD's okay. calculation. So, you know, and I think anybody working within a household, their income does contribute to that household's income.
Not children under 18.
Okay. So this is another of those cleaning house issues that we've seen a number of annexation proposals that satisfied the affordable housing component by transferring the title to the property to a nonprofit housing provider. Verde Village, north of Hellman School, north of Nevada Street, is a good example, a 61-unit development that transferred land for 15 units to be built by Rogue Valley Community Development Corporation at the time. I think that was 2009. So that satisfied the requirement for the affordable housing. The question that has come up is that we have timing requirements in our land use code that stipulate that affordable housing has to be built. 50% of the affordable housing units have to be built before the second half of the market rate units get started. And the final affordable housing unit has to be built before the final market rate housing unit gets a certificate of occupancy. The concern that has been raised because some affordable housing providers are seeking competitive funds from the state, they may not be successful on year one and would be reapplying in subsequent years. But if the property has been transferred to them and it's in their ownership and deed restricted to be affordable housing, again, the question in terms of revising the ordinance is, should that be considered having satisfied that requirement from the for-profit developer so they can move forward with their for-profit market rate homes without having to wait sometime years for an affordable housing provider to get the funding in place to develop. So any thoughts on that one?
Well, my thoughts is it's just a very rational way of going. So it's, it seems like it's just an easy amendment to approve, other than it's just, it fits the overall theme of helping developers. I mean, it probably helps the nonprofits in that they get a little more. Everybody gets a little more flexibility. It makes sense, but it fits that same theme.
It does, and it also does encourage for-profit developers to partner with nonprofit developers to transfer title of land and essentially wash their hands of the obligation to right. do the affordable housing. Yeah. So, in that sense, it's. Seen favorably by for-profit developers, and from the nonprofit side, they acquire land, which is usually a good leverage for seeking grants and funding for development of affordable housing.
And you know, Rich, going back to sort of my introduction, which is that what we've seen over the years is that we're not getting a lot of participation in our programs from for-profit developers. I think that the subsidy needed, the amount of subsidy needed to meet our requirements is a little more than they are used to. And because they're not familiar with affordable housing financing, they don't have access to the same tools that affordable housing developers have or are savvy about how to access those tools, because it's very different than, you know, going down to a bank and getting a commercial loan or, you know, finding investors. It's that strange, complicated process. And so what we have seen is that the organizations or, you know, the developers who do take advantage of all any of our programs are affordable housing providers. And so I think for us, if we can make it easier for affordable housing providers, then hopefully we'll see more development from them. Because, I mean, as we've seen, we haven't really seen that much development at all. And so there's, you know, something within the balance of our programs that's a little bit off and is not incentivizing any development enough. And so, you know, trying to keep that balance is, I think, part of how we're viewing this whole update.
Right. So just, we're kind of running towards the half hour. So I think we need to
pick up the pace.
Got some more stuff to cover here.
Sure.
And I have a question about this next slide about the affordable housing distribution. This is Echo. Sure. So talk first, and then I'll see if...
Sure. I'll start with what the intent of this, when it was drafted and initially put in the code, was in an effort to ensure that the affordable housing units would not be wholly different from the market rate units, clustered in one area and made of different materials. So this slide and the next slide both relate to that concern. The concern is that there's a value in having income distribution and a more inclusive housing development that has not sequestering all the affordable housing units in one area. Through time, applications that we've received both from Habitat for Humanity and self-help program through RVCDC, they requested exceptions to this standards as part of those applications, because their model for development of affordable housing benefited from having the site contiguous to the other affordable units, so they could build them all once or manage them all once. Columbia Care would be another example where, if it is a project that has ongoing supportive services built into it, they need to have a site where the affordable housing is not distributed throughout a project, but is consolidated. And so as each application that's come forward for annexation or zone change has requested a consolidation of the affordable housing and ultimately been granted by the City Council and Planning Commission, the question arose of whether we should remove this provision that requires them to go through that added exception process, which can be discretionary and add vulnerability to a land use application for an affordable housing developer or a for-profit developer. The other aspect of it is that we have very small lots within Ashland. So whereas if you had a 100-acre property that was going to be developing out at 500 units and they were looking at putting 125 affordable units on one side and the other 375 as market rate units separated, that's a scale of development that we don't see within Ashland. We're usually seeing a 13-unit development with four or three affordable housing units. And so the clustering that you'd see is probably most pronounced on this Verde Village site, where you did end up with 15 affordable units altogether. So that's the background on it.
Well, I have a fairly strong gut level opposition to this idea, because the consequence of it, I understand it's convenient for the developer. It may be convenient for the nonprofit as well, but the consequence for people who live in what ends up being a social class segregated section of even a small development stigmatizes them. They're like in the poor folks quadrant of the development. It would inevitably come to be seen that way. And that is one of those examples of really what amounts to institutional discrimination in policy, where policies are made with the best of intention, and often because they're the economics pencil out. But the social consequence of removing that position would be to stigmatize people who live in the poor folks section of a development. And I find this highly problematic.
Does anybody else want to weigh in on this part? We got to move along the way, but I think we ought to see, we have given some feedback along the way, but do other people have anything they want to add on this piece?
Yes, this is Jackie. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just have a different opinion. And Brandon, correct me if I misunderstood. At Verde Village, where you have the condo types of apartments that people use their sweat equity, they got their friends and relatives and people to help build, they're clustered together. Are they not in the lower affordable?
They are. These are the ones that are pictured in this slide.
Right.
And they're townhomes and they're for purchase. So they're not apartments, but they were built and clustered together. Two groups of 7 units in one, 8 in another.
So I just want to give a different viewpoint from Echoes. You know, there are different viewpoints on this, but sometimes that kind of townhome, those are considered very hip and are not looked at by most people as being the lower class or anything. It's actually the more artistic, hip kind of living in that particular area. So I don't see the stigma, for example, in that example. So I just think there are different viewpoints and different ways that things can be built and accommodated so that it doesn't provide that stigma. And I think Verde Village is an example of that.
Do you know, I wanted to jump in really quick. I was on silent, but Echo, I too was wanting to jump in because it's Snowberry, everyone's together. I believe, I don't think they're separated. And when I walk through there, because I live very nearby, I walk my dog, and I don't see that stigma. So I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know if they're all together or if they're separate, but I believe what I see is that they're all together because I don't see that at all, that separation or that stigma. It's Snowberry.
It may not be something that people sort of subjectively experience. But looking at patterns of real estate development in general, and I'm thinking like a sociologist here, frankly, rather than a developer. And I have friends who live in Verde Village, for example. So I've been in those units. So I know them pretty well. In our particular case, they look great. But over time, you know, as time goes by, I think other people in a community start to know that that's where the poor folks are. And the poor folks are more likely to be people of color, although, you know, we're a pretty white community. So I'm concerned about the long-term consequences of having clustered low-income housing. It means that you've got people living next door to each other who have kind of similar social class or other kinds of cultural experiences rather than being next door to people who are different from them, who have different experiences. And it creates a kind of social and cultural segregation as well as the potential for a part of a development to event over time be seen as less desirable. Because that's what's happened in other places. It's happened in other cities. Whether it's going to happen in Ashland, I can't tell you. But it does happen elsewhere.
I understand.
Can I break in and suggest, I think one of the things that we should do is go through each piece. We've gotten a record of our feedback on it. But at the end, our goal is to make a recommendation to the city council. And so I want everyone to think through to what extent they want, they're going to hold out for changes, or are they willing to accept the package? But so, I think we're going to have to get through some other pieces too.
Yeah. So there.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
We do have a couple more slides to go through, and at this meeting, it really is informative. The intention would be to go from this meeting and for staff to then meet with developers, nonprofit developers, lenders, get their feedback on these concepts and develop a land use ordinance that would come back for the commission And it would be that land use ordinance, the resolution, and a resale restriction covenant that would be presented to the Housing and Human Services Commission to get recommendations that then go to the Planning Commission and City Council. So at the conclusion of this talk, we're not going to be requesting of you explicit direction for the council. If you want to give us feedback, that's great. Okay. But it wouldn't be a recommendation to council at this stage.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, I think all of the opinions are really valuable at this point, because this is the information that we can take back when we meet with developers and lenders to talk to them about, you know, what if, you know, what if we continue to require this? Would you keep asking for exceptions? I mean, would you try to make it work? I mean, so that's the thing that, you know, hearing this feedback is how we're going to have that process and then go through with the Planning Commission and that and the council and you, of course, again. So it's good to hear it all.
So just a few more, and the next one has to do with our existing ordinance. Was a lot of the code provisions in our existing ordinance were done in response to potential abuse. And what I mean by that is that we were concerned that a three-bedroom, single-family detached development proposing for annexation would come in and say, well, we're going to provide all of our affordable units as studio apartments above the garages of these six houses and call it good. So we established a standard that said that the affordable housing units have to have a comparable number of bedrooms to the market rate housing units and use similar building materials and be a similar housing type. And so I think that's a laudable approach. At this point in time, I think that the requirement to maintain a comparable number of bedrooms. And I think that we'd want to amend it or greater. So if somebody was doing all two bedroom units, but wanted to do three bedroom affordable units in order to meet the standard, that would qualify. You know, if their housing partner like Habitat was wanting to do three bedrooms. But we also wanted to explore whether allowing different housing types that again, still housed similar household sizes would be possible. For instance, instead of providing all detached single family homes, if an affordable housing developer wanted to do some of those attached townhomes in order to build a project that was more cost effective for the affordable housing units, whether three bedroom townhomes would count as comparable to a three bedroom detached single family home, or whether a two bedroom cottage would count as comparable or a two-bedroom apartment to a two-bedroom single-family or two-bedroom townhome. Again, getting rid of the housing type comparable, part of this rationale is that we see that we have a need for apartments and don't want to throw up impediments for a for-profit single-family home developer to work with a nonprofit housing developer that wants to develop apartments of comparable bedroom size. So that's the intent behind this section. The next one, I think, will probably be a point of considerable deliberation amongst this body and Planning Commission and City Council as well. Looking at the land use ordinance requirements for long-term affordable housing, and I think Linda might be able to speak to this. I would preface that with within the city limits currently, if somebody is developing affordable housing, our systems development charges are waived for those units. They're waived for a 30-year period of time, and we require a 30-year period of affordability. If it is an annexation into the city, it triggers a 60-year period of affordability. And this is an intent to create long-term housing for our community, not necessarily just first-time home buyer program for the first resident that gets into a affordable housing unit. It has been questioned by both Housing Authority and Habitat for Humanity and lenders of whether they can get a loan package that extends for a property that's regulated for a 60-year period. And Housing Authority had indicated that even though their intent and expectation is to keep units as affordable for well longer than 30 years, essentially in perpetuity, at the 30-year mark, a lot of the materials in the building need to be repaired So new roof, new HVAC, those kind of things. And so at that point, they are looking at often refinancing the development in order to pull equity out to make those repairs. And a 60-year term of affordability is problematic in that regard. Did you have anything to add to that, Linda?
I think you covered all the salient points about that, and you touched on the lending. But this goes back again to trying to create a balance in our program where, you know, homeowners can you know, purchase these units, and then these units can transfer when they need to, where affordable housing developers can meet their needs and be able to develop housing. And so when we start hearing from both homeowners and developers that it's our code that is being the barrier to them doing the sort of development that we are asking them to do, that's when it feels like, well, maybe we need to look at what's in our code that is keeping these things from happening, these things that we are saying that we want, that we are offering money to support, but are not coming to fruition. And so, you know, what are some of those barriers? And this is one of the barriers that, you know, affordable housing providers have called out. And as Brandon mentioned specifically with Habitat, even though they do their own loans, their underwriters were reluctant to underwrite loans that were for a term of affordability that went way beyond the life of the loan itself. And in recent years, well, actually not even in recent months, we've been having a lot of issues with lenders and how they're doing their loans and their underwriting. I don't fully understand what's going on in the lending community because I'm not that much a part of it. And so we're going to try to get some feedback from them. But that's one of the things that they have brought up too. And so for homeowners, you know, I mean, we want this program to work for them. And, you know, a homeowner is going to feel uncomfortable if they're hearing from lenders that they won't lend on these homes. Then they're thinking, well, what's going to happen if I have to sell my home and I have to move and someone can't get a loan? You know, you're putting me in an untenable situation. So there again, it's just trying to balance the needs of all of these different parties, but also make sure that we're getting what we want. And I mean, if we're the barrier, then we need to look at how we can help make that work.
Questions? Well, before we go on,
Heidi is muted, but I think she was trying to say something. Heidi, if you could unmute yourself.
Okay. Now, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No.
Yes. We can. We can hear
you. Okay. So, to me, a 60-year span is way too long because most loans are either 15 or 30 year. I just wondered if there's any kind of incentive at 30 years that clearly homes would need to be updated by that time. If the city could offer some kind of incentives to replace the roofs, or I don't know.
So I will state that the Planning Commission wrestled with this, and again, it was a conversation such as this. It wasn't really in depth. But one of the concepts that was raised was at the end of the 30-year period, would there be a potential where that fixed rate, 1.5% a year for those 30 years, is no longer in place? Is there an equity recapture at that point in time that the city could essentially recapture money into the housing trust fund or potentially forgive that recapture with a new 30-year term of affordability, something along those lines? I think it's something that we'd want to explore with the lenders, nonprofit developers, to see if that kind of scenario might resolve some of the barriers that they've raised.
That sounds similar to what I had in mind, too. There may be other creative solutions to that, like lines of credit based on the equity in the home to replace the roof or whatever.
Best practices too in other communities and see what other communities are doing and come back with some different options.
When I was when I saw that this was on the study session, I wrote a letter to the council that said, just myself personally, I was in favor of this package, but it was only a very modest step forward. It's not getting us to where we need to be for affordable housing. But since that time, I've come back to this particular issue, and I guess I had a whole lot of trouble because when you talk to people about Ashland's housing affordability, and there's a lot of cynicism about what that means. They say, well, it's only good for 30 years, and we've seen so many examples of federal money used in 30 years, and it goes back out on the private market, and it's just a scam. And so they like it when I can say, well, we have a longer period of affordability in Ashland. And when I started thinking about that, I wanted to understand better what the barriers are than what I've heard explained so far. And I would like to think that if we've got the time, I would like to hear from a nonprofit developer and a bank or somebody about they don't seem insurmountable to me to have a program that's 60 years and still be able to make repairs on the plan. And many of the programs that we're doing that are with NeighborWorks and others that have a land trust, they're in perpetuity or something, and they seem to be surviving. And so I would just like to understand in way more detail from the outside people about why we would change a really fundamental piece.
Sure.
That's it.
So this is a house cleaning issue that we identified. The annexation ordinance says that projects coming into the city through annexation can only exploit a 25% density bonus for affordable housing, essentially increasing the number of units that they're annexing by 25% if those units are affordable housing. However, within the city limits, we give a density bonus for affordable housing up to 35% for projects that are voluntarily providing affordable housing, and a cumulative bonus up to 60% if they provided another 15% of common open space or conservation bonuses. Really increasing the density of development up to 60%. And so an amendment we would be looking at is essentially aligning the annexation ordinance to those density bonuses that are allowable currently within the city limits, which would allow for a 35% density bonus for affordable housing instead of a 25%. And lastly, the land use ordinance stipulates that in order to annex a property into the city, you have to demonstrate there's less than a 5-year supply of land for that development type within the city limits. When we did the housing strategy implementation plan, which Becky Hewitt presented many months ago at the end of 2019, one of the items in that plan was to remove this 5-year supply requirement, because it puts an undue demonstration that there is less than land available within the city limits and may be an impediment to bringing property into the city as a growth control measure that may have been useful back in the 90s when this was established. But as land within the city has largely developed out, the people adding up all the small lots that have development potential and saying there's still more than a 5-year supply doesn't reflect the ability to annex larger properties that can accommodate larger developments. And as we know, annexation also includes the affordable housing component. So this specific standard would have impacts on affordable housing as well as market rate housing. So we would be looking at eliminating that standard. And that was it for the changes. Again, this is the study. It's not a study session, but an opportunity, an update to the Housing and Human Services Commission. We're going to have those ongoing discussions, draft an ordinance, and then come back through public hearings. And to Commissioner Rohde's point, I think that we would be also inviting other participants in the development of affordable housing and market rate housing and lenders to participate in those public hearings and provide feedback for the commissions to know whether specific changes are neutral in their book or whether they actually would be supportive of creating affordable housing. So that was it.
So are there final questions or should we move to the next agenda item?
I have a question.
Okay.
What about the possibility, Brandon, of attaching something to a bill of sale that says when this affordable housing unit is going to be sold, the city has the right of first refusal, something like that attached. I know that that happened. There are all these different provisions that are attached to various properties. Something like that might give the city a chance to keep affordable housing affordable. If it's been 30 years and now it's being sold, we would be able
to. We do currently attach to the deed of any property that is an affordable unit in our program, a resale restriction covenant that really dictates those price increases for the 30-year period. Within that document, obviously checking with legal about how to incorporate additional wording for an equity share or first right of refusal so that the city could be in a position to retain those units in our housing stock if they were going to be sold, even if it was on year five and somebody needed to sell it, if city had first right of refusal and had the means to purchase the property and now extend it 30 years from when the city acquires it, that could be another mechanism to kind of keep units in the program. Reminds me of the Stratford apartments in which they, at the end of their term of affordability, they sought new USTA funding and added another 30-year period. I think it was 30, maybe 20, to keep them affordable yet again.
I have one question. So on slide 15, we talked about like the dimensions and the setup on how we can like say build on top of garages and things like that. Is there the assumption that there's like a space requirement when it comes to bedroom measurements?
No, there isn't. It would have to meet building code. So you could theoretically do a 3-bedroom, 1,000 square foot townhome, and that would count as a 3-bedroom unit next to a 2,400 square foot, 3-bedroom, detached, single family market rate unit. And they would both qualify as comparable by number of bedrooms. But building code does have stipulations in terms of ingress, egress, and closets and size of those, but they can be quite small. I think that you 2 bedrooms in 600 square feet is feasible. It's pretty tight, but I think that has worked for cottage housing developments.
Can we move to the next agenda item, which is this COVID update? No,
it's the fair housing analysis of impediments. But what are your guys' thoughts? Do you want to have your husband come in and talk for a bit, or
I was thinking we should, that it looked like it was towards the end of the meeting, not.
Okay.
I think we should continue with the agenda as it's proposed. Okay.
So fair housing it is. And Linda, are you going to lead that?
Yep, I am. I have something written on my iPad. So as noted in the introduction to the analysis of impediments to fair housing choice and in the memo, the analysis is a requirement of jurisdictions receiving federal funding. This document, the 2020-2024 AI, is an update of a document previously completed and adopted in 2008-2009. The AI update identifies impediments to fair housing choice in the city of Ashland currently and offers recommendations to address those impediments. The tables found on pages 5 and 6 provide a summary of identified impediments and the recommendation for remediation over the consolidated planning period, that 2020 through 2024. The recommendations include objectives, measurable goals, and action steps for completion, which is a HUD requirement. The recommendations also establish a timeline for completions of each goal, the resources needed, and the partners who will help the city achieve the identified goals. These tables are the most important aspects of this document, as the city will be required to report on the progress of the activities described in the tables each year to HUD. So while the goals and objectives may seem limited, the action steps are in part based on the city's capacity to reasonably complete identified action steps in a five-year period. The city will be required to reevaluate impediments in the following consolidated planning period, so 2025 through 2029, and identify action steps once again. So like all things that come from HUD, this is a prescribed process. They have a guidebook that tells us how to structure these things and also how we need to address them. And so part of our funding that we receive when we do the annual action plan and the CAPR is that they want to see, you know, what did you do this year? What did you say you were going to do and what did you do? So it was really important for us to sort of line up what we could accomplish so that we can make sure and meet that goal, which isn't to say that we don't have a commitment to furthering fair housing. And I think we can look at other ways and how we can partner with other communities. But I think for this document, sort of making sure that we have the capacity to carry out those activities was really important. And just for your background, in years past, I have been told by the Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity that what we should do is look at what Portland provides and do something similar. And every time they say that, I think, Portland gets millions of dollars. And while I'm sure that the activities that they're doing are amazing and that we would love to do those activities, you know, we're just not able to undertake those types of actions with the resources that we have here. Anyway, so I'll go on. The city is also in the process of contracting with the Fair Housing Council of Oregon for testing to supplement the data gathered for the AI update. And you may recall that testing is where they essentially sort of fake shopping for housing. And then they test it by saying, like, you know, I am an English as a second language speaker calling, and I'm looking at this apartment, you know, how much does it cost? Can I look at it? And then call as a person who doesn't have an accent and then ask the same questions and see if the answers are different. So it's a little bit of testing to see what's going on with these things. So currently there is no timeline for completion of the testing yet, but it will be completed before the end of this fiscal year. So June 30th, 2020, we're in the process of contracting with the Fair Housing Council now. And so once we're able to do that, we will set a timeline and we'll keep you updated. The testing is most likely to occur on two specific protected classes, national origin and race. We'll complete the testing on these two protected class, or we are completing the testing on these two protected classes based on the stakeholder feedback which we receive, which has identified instances of racial and national origin discrimination, but it's not showing up in the fair housing complaints and compliance reporting. So there have also been concerns through that stakeholder feedback process about lack of access to fair housing compliance resources for minority populations, as well as a lack of knowledge about fair housing laws among minority populations. So both of those impediments are identified in the table, and we have established action steps to address them in different ways, but that's why we're specifically targeting the testing to those populations, because we're not seeing the evidence that it's there through the complaint process, but we're hearing anecdotally that it's happening. And so now we want to see if we can gather that evidence as well. And then, you know, we've identified steps where we're going to work with our partner agencies and see if we can get more information out to those populations and make sure that it's not that they don't understand that there are rights or that they don't have access to it because maybe we don't have bilingual translations. So once the testing is complete, the staff will update the AI with the findings and provide you with the updates. And so at this point, I would just open it up to group comments. I mean, I'm going to assume that you all read it, and I don't want to go over it exhaustively. And so I think it'd be valuable to hear your feedback.
I have some.
Echo, go.
Okay, so page 21 answered a lot of my questions, that lovely chart. I did want to, the part about in dealing with the limited knowledge and understanding in the community, that row on that chart, it's actually page 22, seemed a little vague. So it says, undertake an information and education campaign through a broad-based approach. And I'm wondering exactly what that might turn out to mean. And that's a bigger issue than we can talk about today. So that's just a suggestion that trying to make that action step a little bit more specific would be helpful. I also wonder if we need to be doing something around educating the community who might be experiencing foreclosures and evictions as a result of pandemic policy. I think everybody's anticipating an uptick in housing insecurity and homelessness and foreclosures. So I don't know where you can insert that maybe into this document, but I'm sure, Linda, you've been thinking about it because I know we all have. I also had a question about the disability ADA issues that turned up in the survey, the community survey that was done. And I'm following up a little bit on what Steffi said in the city council study session on Monday. She raised this sort of a similar issue with what they were talking about. And so I think maybe adding a little bit more clarity on the ADA disability access issues would be good. I would also like to request, there was a part on, I think on the table someplace, I can't remember if it's page 21 or 22. I'd like to get some education personally as a member of the commission from the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services about what they do. I have sort of vague knowledge, but you know, I'm fairly new, so I may not know as much as other people do. And then the last thing I wanted to tell you, Linda, is that it looks like on page 32, there's kind of a Scrivener error. The heading on that table with the that's got the AMI, the income data from the American Community Survey, that table needs to have a better heading on it so that you can tell that it's 2000 and runs up to 2018. I figured it out what it meant, but it was just a typo. That's all. I'm done.
So before we move on to the next question, one thing I wanted to go back to, so one of the ideas for sort of a broad-based community campaign that I had was doing things that are, you know, really broad, like public service announcements, bus ads, things that are sort of more targeted to the general community. And part of that was the feedback that we received from our community survey, which was they were like, what is fair housing? What are you talking about? Like a lot of people just didn't even know, you know, that it existed. So things that I think are very just out in the community and very small. And certainly I have no idea what all that could look like. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to figure that out. And one thing that I didn't bring up in this document because it's so fledgling and new is that the Fair Housing Council of Oregon does have some grant funding right now because of COVID, but right before COVID happened, they had received some grant funding to do some collaborative work in our community, actually across the state, but they've created a group, a Southern Oregon collaboration around fair housing issues. And so we are meeting quarterly to talk about what we are seeing in our communities and then talking about how we can address them and what resources we're needing for education and training and outreach. And so it's we've only met once because COVID happened. And so it's just getting started. And I feel like some of the work that they're going to do will be able to address a lot of these things. I just don't know what that looks like right now. And I was hesitant to articulate it into this document because I feel like there's just a lot more work we're going to do, and it'll all become more clear later. So I just wanted to get that in there, which doesn't really help this document right now. And I've already been in contact with the Fair Housing Council to start scheduling out the sorts of trainings we'll be looking at. And I definitely want to do some more, I mean, it's in this document, some sort of more trainings with elected and appointed officials, but maybe not as targeted as things that we've done in the past. But I think as part of that, we can certainly get the Fair Housing Council to talk more about what they do and how their process works.
Mm-hmm. Is Louise working with you on that? Yeah. Is she? Because as Rich will remember, Louise, a lot of us go way back with Louise, so we're friends.
Yeah, we'll see Louise a lot.
Cool.
She's usually our trainer.
Yay. Yeah.
Thank you, Linda. Are there questions that people have? Gina?
No, Linda actually answered my question, so good job.
Okay, Jackie.
Let's see, am I unmuted? Yes, I am. One of the things I really noticed, and I want to compliment Linda and Brandon, who did the writing on the history of racism in Oregon and presented the past and the present and our steps moving forward in terms of fair housing and where our attitudes maybe have come from and are current and going. So I have a real interest in the emphasizing the diversity, equity, and inclusion training. And I wasn't sure how much throughout the city of DEI training there has been. And I see Linda shaking her head no. And I want to mention Aura. Recently, we had a two-part DEI training, and it can be done for not a lot of money. There are many trainers now, and this is, of course, a very current issue, you know, on the forefront. So I just would like to make sure that we're putting a highlight on that, because it is highlighted in this report several times. And I don't want us to forget. So just want to make sure that we're really getting it into each of the departments in the city where we're getting that DEI training, so that people can see us, you know, walking the talk and then getting it out to the public sector as well.
So I'm glad that you brought that up, Jackie. I am on a board of another organization that actually created a protocol for training, for EDI training. And they actually presented in Washington, D.C. at a conference, because they're one of the only organizations who has an established training that they give to all of their staff members, and now are starting to give it to other organizations. And I remember hearing that and thinking, I imagine that the police department probably does do some trainings, but certainly, you know, we don't get those trainings within our building. Oh, Brandon, you look like you want to say something.
Well, the police department, the implicit bias training is, I think, what you're referring to, which was a training that was provided to all department heads, mid-managers, and various other people throughout the city about 2 years ago. Okay. But that's, you know, again, we have a lot of staff turnover. It's important to reach all levels of staffing as well, and not just isolate it to implicit bias from a police perspective, which was interesting, but doesn't go to the full gamut of what you're referring to.
So I think we'll be exploring that and seeing, yeah, if you wanted to give us your information about the trainers that you guys worked with, that would be great too. Because I think at this point, we know we want to do it. We don't know what that looks like.
I can give you a couple of trainers too that do excellent work. I would really like to see that implemented. And like, you said, Brandon, that was 2 years ago. And so many things have changed in 2 years, our staffing. So, yeah.
I had a question. It's just my assumption was that the testing that the Fair Housing is doing is going to be random and not based on people making a complaint.
Testing.
Well, as far as I know, I mean, I think it will be random because they'll just, you know, find out what is available in the community. We did have to, I actually met with them today over the phone and talked with them about, you know, what we were wanting, and they wanted us to pick specific protected classes so that they could do enough tests to have some meaningful feedback. But I don't think that they're going to necessarily target anyone unless it's something that they do internally. Like it may be that they get a number of complaints about, and just, you know, whatever, a property management company or a specific landlord. So they, if there is a unit on the market, that is represented by one of those, you know, they may call just to say, you know, we hear a lot of complaints, but that's not information they're sharing with us necessarily.
Yeah. I would just say that I've seen both kinds. We did complaint training with Oregon Fair Housing Council a number of years ago, and it's modest, but the ones where they do random testing is very controversial, but that's what you need to get through, and I'm just assuming that that's where we are with that. I mean, it's a great a study that you've all put together, and I hope that we really prioritize it.
Yes.
Well, and I should say that we should thank Rich for going out and doing the stakeholder interviews. So he gathered a lot of really valuable data and spent a lot of time doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
So where are we on the agenda? Oh, Heidi, go ahead.
I wanted to add to this that I thought it was really well written and put together. And I know it took a lot of time, so thank you for doing it. And also, Louise Dix did the training about fair housing for shelters this past year, and it was really helpful, and it was very well attended. I think if we did something like that regularly, not just for shelters, but for all landlords, and what they do in Portland is send a newsletter out and say, if you're a landlord, this is when our next training is. It's free, and they list several dates, and it's really helpful. The other thing is Louise has a lot of posters and handouts about fair housing, and I'm sure she would be happy to give us some, and we could either post them on the Housing and Human Services web or city web space, and that would help educate people as well. They're very simple, but they're succinct, but they're really informative.
So now, are we ready for the COVID update on our agenda, or we got more somewhere else?
Can I add just one brief thing for Echo? I'm sorry if you brought this up and I forgot about the rent and eviction and foreclosure information. So I have been meeting with a group around rent relief and eviction, because we do have funding coming down to help people. And that group is undertaking a communication campaign to let people know where they can go to get assistance and what the laws are and the regulations and how they can get compliance. And so on our city website, on the landlord-tenant page, we do have some of those links already to organizations and to fact sheets. And I can certainly email that out to you guys so that you can disseminate them in any way that you will. And as that gets updated, right now there's rental assistance from Access, and they put it out to a number of applicants. They haven't made any funding decisions yet, but once those funding decisions are made, then we will link on there where people can go to get that assistance.
That'd be awesome. Thank you.
Go ahead, Brandon.
I have a question for Linda, which I probably could have asked before this meeting. Do you need a recommendation from the commission for the analysis of impediments? My understanding is it's to be sent up to HUD and would need to be approved by the city, and this commission is the approving entity for community development block grant documents.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up, Brandon. And yes, we would need a motion.
Motion. Okay, so would someone like to make a motion in relation to our impediment study?
I move that we approve the 2020 to 2024 fair housing analysis of impediments to fair housing choice prepared by Linda Reed and presented what's the date today?
23rd.
July 23rd, 2020.
I'll second.
Well done, Heidi. That was very good. Is there a second?
I'll second.
And Echo seconded. We've had discussion. All those in favor of making this recommendation, say aye.
Or put, aye.
I've got a thumbs up aye. From Tom. Or aye. Say aye. Are we there? Hello?
Yes.
Say aye or something.
Aye.
Okay. Is there any objection? None. No abstention. So it's passed. Yeah. So we're going to go to the COVID update. And it seems to me that the correlation between the healthcare part of it and the housing part of it are totally intermingled. And so I think it would be great if your husband would come in and give us an update about where we are.
Sure. Hold on.
Okay.
I mean, you could go ahead and keep talking. I'll go get it.
Right. Okay. Linda, were you going to lead this?
You know, I think, Rich, you had brought it up to me, which was just that you guys might like to hear, you know, all the things that the city's been doing. Since, you know, we talked back in March and we talked back again in May. You know, we've provided money to ORA to house people in hotels for a time, and then that sunsetted. We also supported ORA with some funding to reopen the laundry shower trailer and to get that running again. And then we also supported ORA in helping with the meal delivery. We also supported Peace House in preparing the meals. So those are the primary activities that we've been undertaking to address COVID in this time. And I know there are other things that people are doing. And so I think, Rich, you were curious about if there were other things going on.
Here's my question, and then maybe we can all think about it, is if we hear, and what we seem to be, is that the healthcare difficulties that we have are not going away, and people who are homeless are facing probably the same issues that they faced back when we sent emergency money to motels and hotels, and we struggled with the issue about where do we have people in congregate camping, or how do we do that? Are we not sort of in the same place now as we were a few months ago? And should we as a commission be thinking about the same kinds of strategies?
Oh, is Linda going to say something? Rich, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, you can? You know, I wanted to, I know we're coming to the end of this meeting, so I didn't know if we could put it on our next meeting's agenda, but kind of where we left the Hardesty property is the zoning of it, and I found out through one of, I shared, Deanne was there from United Way. La Clinica was there. Brenda said she'd be more than happy to put mental and physical health care into one of those units. The garages, they have all air conditioning and heating. It's fabulous in there. And one thing that being able to, if the city would annex the property so that we could change the zoning, and it's my understanding from speaking to Chad and Deanne that we would have to present it, I believe, to the planning commission and then to the council, and the council can change the zoning for that. This is not going to go away anytime soon, and when it does go away, we're still going to have unhoused residents. So look, I'm looking at the big term of things, the big picture of things, and the people who have bought into it and who are committed to seeing it through are amazing. And I believe Aura went a couple of last week, because they didn't come with us when we went. Michelle couldn't make it. So I can reach out to Michelle and see what their take on it was. But I'd like to put that on the agenda and see if we can move forward with that. I don't want to see it just fall by the wayside.
Okay.
You're talking about the urban growth boundary?
Actually, I'm talking about the Hardisi property.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and part of that property is in the city and part of it's right. County. However, if we can take it, the city can annex that property so exactly. that we can change the zoning. And so it can be done, and it doesn't have to take forever. So I just wanted to see if we can. We probably don't have time to discuss it now, but I would love to see it on the agenda. I hope we can do this again next month. Maybe I can get feedback from Aura also, but it can be done.
Month's agenda. We have Dr. Shames here. If you've heard our questions, we're really would like to get a kind of an update from your perspective about where homeless people, are they going to be facing the same COVID questions that they had back at the early part of our infection here? And should we be addressing that issue? And do we have more criteria from the health folks about how homeless people should be housed? You're going to need to unmute.
Yes, I will.
Okay.
So, you know, it's summertime, and folks are always safer when they're out of doors rather than when they're indoors. So perhaps we have some grace period here. But once people are going to come back inside in congregate settings, I don't think this is going to be over. And I think that's going to really increase the kind of risk we have. You're probably aware of what's happening right by the Greenway in Medford in terms of access, working with the city of Medford and law enforcement, and they're creating a what they perceive to be a safe place where people can camp and receive services. And it may be that there's going to be a lot to be learned from that. You know, maybe it'll be viewed as really very successful and you can model something after it, or there'll be a whole lot of ways in which it didn't work out as expected, and you learn from that as well. I have to say I was more concerned about the spread of COVID among the houseless than turned out to be, you know, to come to pass, or at least so far. And I find that interesting, but it could be that just the nature of kind of the way their living situation is structured, that there's perhaps less contact, less mingling, less ways for the virus to spread. But so far, as a population, at least in our community, they've done fairly well from a COVID perspective.
So the question about winter shelters, for example, would they still be possible with a lot of mitigation?
you know, I'm impressed at all the ways in which things that I didn't think we could do, we're doing, because we're just rethinking, you know, what that might be like. So I have certainly have concerns about the winter shelter, the way it was structured before. Lots of people, lots of bunks right next to each other, you know, communal eating situations. Those are risky. They'll be risky this winter. They were risky 3 months ago. So it's probably going to need to look different with a lot more spacing and, you know, I don't know. But I'm sure you can do it in a way that makes it safer. There's, you know, we've got residential treatment programs in Medford, the MOMS program, and what's happening at Kelly Shelter and other places. And I hear that, you know, that they're mitigating some of the risk so that, you know, perhaps it could be done. It would certainly, now would be the time to plan for it.
Yeah. So are there other questions that we could ask Dr. Shames that people want to know? Linda.
So I've been working with the Homeless Task Force and the Jackson County Continuum of Care to look at ways that we can address this in the coming months. And I know that there's just a lot of concern all around. We are looking at continuing to do the spacing out of meals into the fall. I know that has been proposed. And I just wonder if there's going to be a time in the near future where certainly like the meals can go sort of back to the way that they were. And the only reason I bring that up is that, you know, the structure of having to deliver the meals and preparing the meals, I mean, it's definitely more expensive to do it this way than it was to do it before. And I know that at this point, like there, you can have a certain number of people congregating. I just don't know if the meal situation is a less safe activity, I guess.
Maybe there needs to be some group that meets with representation from public health to start, you know, working through the details, and, you know, you could present kind of what your limitations are. And I don't know if you know Chad Peterson from Environmental Health. This is what he does. He works with organizations to help them do what they need to do in as safe a way as possible. And I would think that an initial meeting with Chad and whoever else would be the appropriate folks would be a way to start, you know, thinking about what you're going to do next.
Well, and I think, you know, the non-congregate feeding, the way we've been doing it has been working. But yeah, as the weather gets colder, how are people going to be able to do that into the winter?
Right.
You know, I had a question.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I had a quick question going back to the shelters and looking at the winter time. In April, the end of April, beginning of May, or might have been the beginning of May, I toured the Kelly Shelter. And in touring the Kelly Shelter, the bunk beds were there, and there was just like a piece of heavy-duty plastic or something, and then some had like plexiglass in between the bunk beds that were stacked up. And when we were talking early about the shelters here and agreeing that now is the time to reimagine this, is that the way it would look? But one thing I did notice at the Kelly Shelter is that the bunk beds were all still in place, and there was just the plexiglass between them. Is that how we're envisioning it?
Well, I haven't been to the Kelly Shelter, and I had asked if somebody could walk around with a phone camera and sort of show me what was happening. So I'm really relying on what Chad has told me. And the bottom line is, I don't know that I would hold up the Kelly Shelter as a model to emulate. You know, sometimes you dodge the bullet and sometimes you don't. And I really don't know what it looks like now. That was April. You know, I was told that they were creating some tents in their parking lot, and they were going to depopulate. And it could be that what you saw was an interim. But I had some contact with them during that early period of time as well. And I had concerns. I just don't know what they ended up with.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was there, they were getting ready to move in the back because they did close up the parking lot area. But it still seemed a bit much. Everyone had their mask on. And I just wanted to kind of reimagine what that would look like in Ashland.
Yeah. It may be different.
Echo.
Dr. Shames, can I ask you a question about testing and contact tracing among unhoused populations?
Sure.
How are we doing that?
Well, testing is not going well for anybody.
Great.
We have a huge, I mean, don't get me started, sort of. But there are a lot of changes, a lot of things that are dynamic that are happening. I think we have the capability of doing on-site testing. Valley Immediate Care is gearing up to be able to take a van to a location and do testing. I think that we should think about that. But that gets to a more fundamental question of when is it appropriate to test asymptomatic people? And I would say the time that it might be appropriate is if you're going to create a congregate setting. So if you're going to have a shelter and you have people coming in and they're at risk, some sort of screening before they enter and maybe some sort of episodic screening might be appropriate. So I think all of us are led to believe that lots and lots of testing of asymptomatic individuals is going to really be helpful. And maybe it would, but we're so far from that, that we really probably need to focus the majority of our testing on symptomatic people and get them tested as quickly and efficiently as we can, and then episodically test asymptomatic people in a high-risk setting. So an example would be you have a skilled nursing facility and one of the people who works there has COVID. You might want to test all of them. None of them have symptoms. Find out what you're dealing with and kind of do that until the problem's over. So that's probably more than you want to know about.
Did I understand correctly? I think I read this, that in order to get into some of the shelters, whether it's Dunhouse or Kelly, or that people have to get tested before they can be admitted?
That may be. There are some places that are setting that up as a criteria. And the governor has decreed that starting by the end of September, every long-term care facility will have to have all of its residents and all of its workers tested, and then test all of the people that work there every month. And she kind of came up with that on her own. And it's unclear how we're going to pull that off, especially with less testing capability now than we had, let's say, 2, 3, 4 weeks ago. We're trying to use as appropriate tool. There's some innovative and new ways of testing that are beginning to be discussed. I just came off a meeting an hour or so ago where there's some very exciting new possibilities for us in terms of testing. But what we have right now is a very long lag time for most people to get their test results back.
Thanks. You have an incredibly difficult job, and I just want to give you a shout out and thank you for everything you do for the community. I know it's incredibly difficult.
Thank you. We've all got tough jobs. You guys are doing great work too.
So I'd like to suggest, Gina suggested that we could get the question about the Hardesty problem or property on the next agenda, but could we continue this discussion and maybe bring in people from ORA or others that might, but I think our role oftentimes becomes the funders for where we're going to go this fall and winter. And so I think rather than wait till we get hit with discussions about, thanks, Jim, for coming. Sorry.
Thank you.
That we ought to kind of be prospective about this and see how we can match funding with the most appropriate strategy rather than kind of shotgunning money out there. And it seems like now could be the time to start that at our next meeting, but how do others feel?
I'm for it.
So are there other updates that we need to have this afternoon?
Well, Jim brought up the campground in Medford, which I believe some of you probably know is scheduled to open on the 27th. Mm-hmm. And I actually missed the last meeting because I had a conflicting meeting. So I'm not sure if there were any updates on how that's going. But the last I heard was they expect to house 25 people. So I don't know if that number has been increased. I did get an email about how to refer people there and to get organizations to sign up to offer services. And so I can share that information if you don't have that information already and you would like it.
Thank you.
Oh, Chris.
I just have one last question or concern, and I think Linda touched based on this a little bit. And it was about the upcoming eviction, the rent eviction moratorium. What is the city's position or what is this commission's position on how to address that if we are facing a lot of people losing rent? I know that Linda mentioned there was some funding available, but let's say that we have a lot of folks that are 2 months behind and that's several thousand dollars. Like, do we have endless money to cap this, or what does that situation look like?
So, Access received some state funding, and I can't remember how much they received, $800,000. I'm not sure how much money they have in total. They actually received two allocations of rental assistance. They have to have their rental assistance money spent by the end of December, and they can pay back rent. So as much as people, can it can go back. So this is the other thing I should have mentioned. The city has given over an award of $50,000 to address rental assistance. But one of the things that we realized, our money has a long period. We don't have to spend it. I mean, we have like 6 years or something. And the Access money has to get out the door. So Access put out a grant application, an RFP and accepted grant applications. I know that ORA applied. I know that UNITE applied as well. I'm glad, Chris, because I know you work with college students, and we had intended to reach out to the college to see if people were needing assistance and how to sort of tie in with that population. But one of the issues is, so in this group that I've been working with around this rental assistance issue, there have been the property managers as well. And the property managers have said that some people are not taking this seriously at all and have not paid rent and have not dealt with it at all. And come September 31st, they are going to be in big trouble. Like I said, there is going to be some, there should be out there in like the next week, and I'll certainly get that information out to you, but there will be assistance, and people need to start getting on it now. There is a process as well for when they get to the end of September, if they still owe rent, they can ask for to make a payment plan, but they need to do it in writing and they need to give that to their landlord. So there's a lot of pieces, and I think the piece that the rental assistance group has been talking about is making sure that we get the word out there and that we don't find these people who just were overwhelmed and didn't deal with it or didn't think it was going to be an issue and that they had time to deal with it, and then find themselves in a situation where it's the end of September, they haven't done a letter, all the rental assistance money is out the door, and now they can't use CDBG to pay back rent. So that was, I think, a really good question, and I should have brought it up before.
Thank you.
Linda, do you know if St. Vincent's knows about that grant?
Yes. No. St. Vincent, well, I you know what? I have not talked to our St. Vincent. St. Vincent and Medford is on the call as well, or on the meeting call. St. Vincent and Medford also receive some CDBG money from, or whatever, not CDBG money, whatever money they got from the city of Medford for rental assistance. Our St. Vincent de Paul is not doing CDBG rental assistance anymore, but they still are doing rental assistance. So people can still go to them. They're just not doing the CDBG program.
So they would be eligible for this access grant?
Well, the access grant application period closed, and I don't think they applied. There's been a lot of questions about capacity. So people are feeling like there's going to be a landslide of people needing rental assistance, and they do need to go through a process, and access is requiring that whoever administers it has the homeless management information system so they can input the data. And that's a whole another administrative burden that a lot of organizations just couldn't manage. And so organizations that had HMIS already, like Aura, were able to go ahead and say, yeah, we can do that. We know how to use it. We have licenses. It's already in our system. There are other organizations like Unite who don't have access to that system and will have to get set up, and also don't have extra people to take, you know, have people at their door and taking all this information and doing that process. So that's definitely been an issue. But I think if people are needing that rental assistance, they can certainly go from St. Vincent de Paul potentially to Aura.
What about utility bill help in the city of Ashland? Is that happening?
So St. Vincent de Paul still does do utility bill assistance. Right now we're putting together the contract for Aura, and so I don't, they're putting together a proposal of what all will be included in the program they offer. They did ask me about whether they could include rental assistance, and they can. I let them know that they can, but I don't know that they will. I imagine, I mean, you know, if that's a barrier, I would imagine they would address it.
Okay, so do we have more on our agenda, Linda? We have we always go to announcements and liaison reports, et cetera. So do you have anything to liaison?
Well, there's a lot going on all over, and we're just trying to keep on top of it and, you know, just keep figuring out what's going on and helping where we can, and just keeping on top of all the new information because it just changes daily.
So do people have any announcements they want to make before we head out? Anything?
Are we likely to meet again? And is it going to be another 2 months? Are we going to try to meet next month? Do we have any clue?
I don't know if Brandon, you can answer that.
The directive that we had from the city administrator was that commissions could meet when they were dealing with time-sensitive issues that were requisite and specifically related to COVID. Part of the rationale behind getting this meeting agenda up was the analysis of impediments was a HUD-required document and had a timeline associated with it. But that said, I think that there is movement to open up Zoom meetings and allow public participation, as we did this evening, I think is the first meeting in which a member of the public had been able to join and listen to a Zoom meeting that's not published on television. So with that success in hand, we'll talk to the city administrator about whether we can have monthly meetings with this commission going forward. But again, there's quite a number of commissions, and each one I think is going to be looked at as to the issues that they're wrestling with, whether it's requisite in relation to the emergency. A lot of the work that you guys do clearly falls in that category. So I would hope that we would probably be back to monthly meetings, but I can't speak for the city administrator.
I don't want to let the mental health side of the commission's mission sort of let that totally slide. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what's happening with the mental health stuff. And then doing some advanced planning for winter, as Dr. Shames just, you know, mentioned, that seems pretty critical. And the sooner we start having that conversation, it seems to me the better.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I second both of those.
I agree with that. And I would also, I would think that the Hardisty property is time sensitive also, because we can always, I'm hoping, ask the city council if we could do this as a temporary thing, if they would allow us to do this, and if it comes through and it's successful, that we can continue it. So I believe that's time sensitive also.
Well, thank you, everyone. I feel really good that we've been able to move these things forward, and I certainly hope we continue on. So I guess we can adjourn right on time. Thank you.
I just had one question. Would it be appropriate to have a subcommittee start doing something with the Hardisty property? Whose responsibility is that? And it seems complex because it seems like it involves a lot of different, the city council and different departments.
Yes. Heidi, I would love that, because it's something that I just got on the phone and I called Adam Hanks. And then when Dennis Slattery was at our last meeting and he said that we would get no resistance from the city, I just kind of ran with it. He cracked the door open and I ran with it and invited some partners that I felt like could buy in. So I think it would be great to have a subcommittee so we could have movement and come back next month and have real, real facts to bring to the table with true buy-in. I think that would be great. Are you willing, Heidi?
As long as it's all via phone or Zoom or something like that. But I'm not sure where to start. And
don't we call them work groups, and people can volunteer to be part of them.
Yeah.
And then someone needs to be the convener to do that. So Gina, you can be the convener.
Okay.
Then the question is, who else would like to be part of that work group?
This is Linda, who hasn't said anything for the whole meeting, but I would be part of that work group if you'd like.
Thank you, Linda.
I would offer my understanding of Oregon land use and City of Ashland annexation policies to at least illuminate what the process would be for expansion of an urban growth boundary and annexation.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Great. Well, I really hope then that we are able to come back next month, because it sounds like we have several things that we could really make some progress with. And again, I'm just going to thank everyone for their strong participation tonight, and particularly the staff that came up with great proposals. Really, that's good work when you're not able to get together, but really make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nobody wants to leave, but I guess we got to say goodbye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you. Goodbye. Take care.